Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here for our interview episode with David Canfield. Hello, David.
Hello.
David, what a joyous day for us both.
What a joyous day.
You got to talk to Emma Thompson, star of Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, a somewhat surprise entrant into this year's Oscar race, as we've discussed already. But, like, who wouldn't relish the opportunity to talk to Emma Thompson? What did you guys talk about?
We talked about everything. We did talk about streaming quite a bit. You know, the movie is this very intimate, theatrical two-hander in which she plays a teacher who hires a sex worker to have an orgasm because she's never had one before. And it's a really beautiful script, and it's just brilliantly performed by both her and Daryl McCormick, who plays the sex worker in question, about these two people getting to know each other both emotionally and sexually. And for Emma, in the context of this movie, being on Hulu was kind of a special thing because it is so much about our private lives that, you know, having it go into people's homes and talking to people about experiencing it in their homes was special. And she makes the argument in this interview that why wouldn't that be worthy of consideration? Because it was the right mode for which this movie to be seen. It was released in cinemas internationally. We've, of course, talked on this podcast about the, you know, evolving eligibility guidelines here, but I think she makes a really compelling point.
That is a really lovely thought that had not occurred to me in a lot of my talking about Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. And I think there's power in seeing something like that in a theater, which, you know, people around the world, I guess, got the chance to. But that's a really nice way to put it. Of course, she managed to put it in a really lovely way.
Of course she did. We also talked a lot about this coming from a first-time screenwriter. Her last, I think, really juicy film role was in Late Night, which was Mindy Kaling's first feature script, and talking a lot about wanting to elevate voices like that and herself having a big screenwriting debut a long time ago, Sensibility, which brought her to the Oscars. So there was a lot of full circleness to the conversation as well.
Well, I can't wait to hear the rest of it. Let's hear your conversation with Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today to talk Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, and your beautiful Hulu movie, which has been newly designated eligible for Oscar consideration. Thank God. It deserves it. It deserves it. We on this podcast have been speaking for a long time about it deserving exactly that.
That's so sweet of you. It's so lovely. I mean, I didn't mind at all because it's not sort of why we do it at all. But I think for the writer and the director, it is a wonderful thing. Having said that, of course, now we won't get nominated for anything at all. And this podcast will become a kind of famously sort of hubristic and kind of slightly embarrassing thing that people will roll out. Do you remember when she did that podcast on that thing called Little Gold Men. And then the film was roundly ignored by every single award ceremony after that. Yes, well, that's what happens when you get too big for your boots. That's the sort of thing that happens in this country, David.
All for naught. But we're here, so we may as well make the best of it, right?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. I did want to start with the streaming question because it's an interesting streaming-only movie in that you are more, I'm going to say naked as an actor, I mean that figuratively for the most part, than you are typically. And you're really going straight into people's living rooms and homes. Did that feel like a vulnerable kind of experience for you? What was the, how did you observe the release of the movie from that perspective?
It was a very interesting journey, actually, for me, the release of the movie, because when we first saw it in a tiny little screening room in Soho, and the pair of us sat there, and we had to hold on to each other all the way through, and then at the end we couldn't really speak because it's been such a sort of intense experience, and actually, of course, in a way, a bizarre way, an extremely private experience that then became, you know, a public one. And I would say that the most vulnerable I felt was in Berlin at the film festival in this massive cinema that was like a bloody football field. I mean, huge wraparound room where we were, you know, we were pretty large on screen. And when they told me that it was going to stream, I thought, in a way, in America, there's, I think, more puritanism about sex and sexual pleasure even than there is here. And there's a lot here. And I thought maybe it's easier for people to see it in their homes. And I've spoken to so many people who've watched it in different ways. And they've said, you know, I prefer to watch it on my own. I decided halfway through I was watching it with my husband, dad, whatever, to actually stop for a minute, and because it's very personal and it brings an awful lot of things up for people. And so I thought it was a very good decision, actually. I was also extremely glad that we opened it all around the world in cinemas, you know. But I watch a lot of things that I can't get to in the cinema. And when I get to them on the small screen or, you know, my telly, which is reasonably large, I'm very, very grateful to have had the chance to see them. And I think that with Leo, which is a tiny movie, you know, a little independent movie, this was the best way of getting the most people to see something that's, after all, you know, about two people in a bedroom. It couldn't be more intimate and therefore sort of perhaps in a sense more appropriate for home viewing.
And to the point about it being a small movie, a very, very dialogue-driven movie, it does make you wonder how a film should be considered, say, for an Oscar nomination, because this is the path it could take to find an audience. You know, as someone who's worked in film for a long time, who's been a part of big movies, small movies, everything in between, what did you make of the debate of whether, you know, it needed to be released in U.S. theaters to be considered and, you know, basically the state of independent movie? Because increasingly it is in a streaming world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it reminds me of a little bit of all the debate that came around when video started. I'm old enough to remember that, you see. So, and everyone said, it's going to kill cinema. Didn't kill cinema. You know, cinema's going to kill theatre. Didn't kill theatre. COVID's going to kill theatre. Everyone's gone back to the theatre. We all get into a bit of a panic, I think. And I'm old enough to remember all of those panics and to know that actually, in the end, really great stories do find their way out a lot of the time. I'm not underplaying the fact that I'll find something and suddenly go, God, why didn't I see this at the time? Because everything's so under the sort of huge tsunami of massive movies. And if at the Cannes Film Festival, you've literally got fighter jets going over to Maverick, I go, well, look, if we're not going to be supported by independent movie film festivals, then that's something that's got to be taken responsibility for. You know, we can't just put all our eggs into the baskets of these enormous great movies that whatever happens, they have to be formulaic, otherwise they don't make the money back. They have to meet the expectation, and the expectation is very clearly laid out. And whilst I love going to see big movies, I really do enjoy it. But independence has always been, you know, where I've made mine, really. And I don't know, we had this argument about the Meyerowitz stories with Noah Baumbach in Cannes. And Noah was very upset about not being eligible because the film had been streamed. And I understand that if you're a filmmaker, you know, and you've made something that's coming out of your heart and you want to see it on the big screen and that's where you've designed it for, it's extremely upsetting to think of people watching it even on an aeroplane. You know, I understand that. I do. And I don't think there's any simple answer at all. I really don't. But I did say to Noah at the time, so many more people will see it. And actually, it's for story as well, isn't it? It's not just this kind of visual feast which is the reason we go to the cinema. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have wanted, for instance, to watch Dune on a telephone. Right. I went to the biggest cinema in London to see Dune, and I just adored every second of it. I just loved it. Loved the kind of massiveness of it and feeling like you're in you are really on a different planet. It was absolute heaven. But I know that you don't have to go to a huge cinema to see Leo. You don't have to. At the same time, it's a completely different experience because Sophie Hyde has rendered our faces and our bodies this landscape. It's so interesting, isn't it, how movies play differently in different shapes and sizes. And because I'm not a director, I don't perhaps feel as threatened, if you like, by something like streaming. I don't really. I know that I still love going to the cinema, and people do absolutely go to the cinema. But, you know, particularly in America, when there's all those sort of loads and loads of places in America where they're not going to put this movie on. And in our little village in Scotland, our town in Scotland, I went into the local cinema and said, are you going to get this movie? Because it's going to be, you have a wonderful time with it, I think. And they said, no. So I organised a screening, which was full. And then another screening where I did a Q&A, which was like crammed. But, you know, people don't, they get out of the habit as well. And they also, I think, in small local places, they assume that the cinema won't be full and there'll be a place for them. So again, all of these questions are questions we have to ask the public. What is it they want? And if they want independent cinema, they have to go and see it. They have to go to the independent cinemas and support them. You can't just say, independent cinema, oh, isn't it a shame, blah, blah. You have to actually go and support them by going to the independent cinemas and choosing them over the big complexes. So yes, we have to make this happen ourselves. It's a personal responsibility as well as, you know, a philosophical discussion about art.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I think one of the benefits of making a movie like this for you as an actor, and what's so striking about your performance, is that this character is so complete and complex and ordinary to an extent. And I was thinking about, you know, some of your recent performances that I've really enjoyed, like Years and Years, Cruella late yeah. night. And these are all larger than life figures. And here you get a very different key to play, which I imagine was pretty exciting.
Absolutely. The way I always put it when I was thinking about it is that she's the person who is always standing next to the person who's doing the interesting thing. Hmm. And suddenly she's the one doing the interesting thing. And you suddenly realize that this very ordinary woman who's lived a very ordinary, decent, useful, complex in all the normal human ways life has suddenly decided to do something absolutely extraordinary, actually, and really see it through, even though it's like watching someone who's never done a bungee jump before just moving just slowly, pace by pace, towards the edge of the cliff. And playing her terror was really one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done, because it was so funny, but at the same time it was also so heartbreaking, so heartbreaking. And the ordinariness of her struggle with herself and her incapacity to think that she even deserved any pleasure, the fact that she'd never really asked herself that question before, but suddenly it was something rising up inside her, you know, that she just couldn't suppress anymore. And I think that does happen with some people.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw you mention rehearsing with Daryl, your co-star, for a day in the nude, which is I would imagine a first-time experience for you and for him. What did that give the two of you in terms of your chemistry in the movie? And also, what was that experience like for you pre-filming, just in terms of being so vulnerable in that way?
It was just wonderful. I knew that we had to do it. And I had done nudity before. I spent two delightful days nude with Jeff Goldblum when I was in my 20s. We were both so nervous. It was in The Tall Guy, and we were so nervous. We both had indigestion, I think, for 2 weeks beforehand. But once we got into it, we just had the best time. And actually, that has always stood me in good stead, because I always remember thinking, oh, it's okay, it's fine, it's all right. As long as you're calm, everyone else is calm. And Sophie and me and Daryl, we'd all said, we have to take our kit off before the day. Otherwise, it'll just feel too pointed, if you'll pardon the unfortunate expression. And Sophie Hyde, our director, is absolutely wonderful, wonderful woman. She's arranged it so that at the end of this 5-day rehearsal period, which we really needed because we wanted to block it all out, we had so much to set up because we only had 19 days to shoot the whole thing, which was a lot. I mean, it was a lot. We shot 12-page sections often, you know, so the performance aspect of it was just so intense. So we needed to get as much under our belts, as it were, as possible. And so then the last day, she cleared the little rehearsal space, which had already become quite womb-like. And I jokingly said, oh, Soph, you know, you'll have to take your clothes off as well. And she said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. And then she sort of thought about it, and then she said, oh, all right then. So we all took our clothes off sort of bit by bit, and each time we did, we said, this part of my body means this to me. And in this part of my body, I have felt these things. And in this part of my body, I've got this scar, which came from this experience, or I've got an internal scar, or this is the bit that I like, this is the bit I don't like, I find this bit difficult. And so we talked our way through our bodies in that very, and it becomes normalized incredibly quickly, because of course, we are but poor bare-forked animals under our clothes, all of us. So it's not like we're suddenly revealing, I don't know, an extra head. It's going to be normal, sure. Whatever it is, you know. And then we did a very interesting exercise where we drew around our bodies on paper. And we map things in, and the internal things and little bits and cross-hatched bits that we felt were important. And we also sort of touched each other's skin, because, you know, you have to feel the person that you're going to have to be very close to physically. And I just remember darling Daryl, who's an absolute glory, a glorious young man, and who's in his representation of Leo, I just think, oh God, I hope every young man looks at this young man and thinks, I would like to be like him, because he's such a great role model. Anyway, he was looking at my hand and he was moving the skin over the bones in my hand. And he said, yeah, you know, the skin sort of moves. It moves quite easily over your bones. And I said, yeah, that's because the cells in my hand are what started forming about 40 years before you were born. So that's why. But it was so touching that he didn't know that the reason that was happening on my hand was because I was so old.
Right.
And the skin is 63 years old, you know, and his skin doesn't do that because it's 28 years old. And those kinds of experiences were very, very moving. And it's, of course, it's a very, it's very tender. And we've said a lot, so it's, I don't want to bore you, but we've said that whenever people ask us about that last couple of days when we did have to strip off and do the sex scenes, that it was just such bliss. It was such bliss because, as well, Nancy and Leo are happy. They're enjoying themselves. They're giving each other pleasure in an incredibly deep and intimate way without it being romantic or indeed particularly complicated. And there was something incredibly releasing about that. And, of course, there were no words. Apart from my favourite ad lib of all time, which I didn't know was going to happen, but when it made me laugh so much, when we got the biggest laugh from us every time, is when she gets to the edge of the bed, so I can't balance here, I can't balance here, you know, and it's just such.
Oh wow, that wasn't scripted. Fun.
Such fun.
Oh wow, that's great. Just thinking about you guys exploring each other in that way. I know you've said this movie made you re-recognize, you call it the waste of time of not accepting one's body. And obviously a lot of comes with that as an actress who's been in this industry for a long time.
Right.
So did you come to a new kind of place in that process? I would imagine there's a certain amount to unlearn just in making a movie like this, which counters a lot of what Hollywood tells particularly women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You can't unlearn it because it's brainwashing.
Yeah.
It's just, I've been brainwashed since I was very young, and the brainwashing continues. I think it's worse actually now because it's continued on social media. So
Absolutely.
Instead of people saying we are now going to inhabit the world in our real selves, in our real forms, people are taking their forms and photoshopping them themselves. So everything that I was brought up with, which only happened in magazines, is now happening to people on people's phones. So that this notion of the ideal and the perfect, industrialized, banal and tedious, though it is, has been made even more of a thing. And thus we're looking at kids as young as 8 saying, oh, I don't like my thighs, I don't like this. But, you know, anorexia hugely on the rise. So it's something that I've fought against all my life, but you know, I can't fill in those runnels. I just can't do it. But I can try to be the change. You know, I can do that at least. At least I can be honest, and at least I can say, look, I accept this now. I accept this condition, my condition. I accept my body. I don't have to love it, but I accept it.
You mentioned Sophie, your director, who makes a wonderful film here, but it's also Katie Brand's first feature script, which is pretty remarkable. You starred in Mindy Kaling's first scripted feature as well, Late Night. Yes. And you, of course, came out with a bang yourself with your first scripted feature in Sense and Sensibility. And it feels to me like there is a kind of nice full circle element there of getting these really rich roles written by these women who have said that they were inspired by you to some extent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been just two of my favorite things ever. Mindy's script You know, and women I know, I didn't know Mindy, and she said, oh, I've written this for you. And that's such an honour and a privilege. But the fact that added to the honour and privilege, it's a fucking great script and brilliantly funny and great to play. It's one of my favourite jobs. And then also with similarly with Katie saying, well, I'm not sure. I know. So I just have a little look. And I go, Katie, this is fantastic. We have to make it. That connection, that circular thing is just, because that's sustainability in essence, isn't it? It's like you make something and then you make something for the next generation, or you be the thing and then the next generation says, oh, yes, okay, that's possible. I'll do that. That's sustainability. That's the sort of circle as you talk about. It's how mm-hmm. we feed each other. It's how we support each other. And so I'm incredibly privileged to have had those women write those pieces. And you know, they're things we've never seen before. Right. We've never seen a late night talk show host. We've never seen a woman in search of an orgasm in that way, exploring as well other entirely taboo subjects like motherhood and, you know, being a useful member of society. You know, she says, well, I could have done something else. Why did I do that? It might have been better if I hadn't. I might have had a better life. And whilst I'm not an individualist in the sense that I think that, you know, having the best possible life for yourself is the most important thing in the world. I believe that we are all connected and that we have to be, we have to be cooperating all the time with each other. You know, we can't just go off and say, well, I'm going to do this and it doesn't matter about everybody else. I don't adhere to that either. I think we're social animals. We belong in social groups. And when we're in those groups, we're in service, actually, to one another. And I think that's right, too. But there's a difference between the sort of baleful kind of suppressive and repressive effects of patriarchy on women, particularly on women's freedom, that have to be changed because they're not good for anybody. They're not good for anybody. And they're very much, I think, at the root of much of the violence against women and girls.
Hmm. For directors and screenwriters specifically, do you see that changing at all? I spoke to Maggie Gyllenhaal last year about her directorial debut, and she'd mentioned you saw an early cut of the film and you'd spoken about it. And she said that she just had no mental space to consider herself as a filmmaker, even though she realized that's really what she's been all along.
Mm. No, absolutely. I mean, that's what we talked about. And her presentation of the hell and the torment of motherhood, if it's not what actually you want to do, was brilliant. And of course, it's Elena Ferranti as well, who's also represented female relationships with other females and with themselves so brilliantly in all her run of Neapolitan novels. But Maggie and I have talked about this for years and years since we met on Stranger Than Fiction. And then she came and did My Nanny Wet Fee. And so we've been mates for a long time and have talked about all of this for a very long time. And actually one of the things that should be, and I think is becoming part of a mainstream conversation, is that you don't have to have babies to be a complete woman. You just don't have to do it. And I think there's still a huge taboo about that. Huge. And of course, you know, then you become a mother and you realize that everything's your fault. Because everything's the mother's fault, everything. And in popular psychology, that's changing a bit. But certainly when psychology began, that was everything. And it was all written by men. And it was all very bad science. And all of this stuff has to be unpacked, taken apart, and redefined, you know, re-explored. And all of these movies that we're talking about are doing that. And I find that quite hopeful. Because if I, as a single person, have been sort of part of three of those sort of journeys, either in actual person or in conversation, I feel that's quite, well, it's hopeful, isn't it?
Yeah, quite meaningful, I think.
Yeah, to me, it's very meaningful, very meaningful. Yeah.
The other side of that, I suppose, is, are there things that you look at now and you say, I don't want to do that anymore? Or, you know, because we are talking about a collection of very interesting characters and films. And that isn't necessarily the journey that many actresses of a certain age get to have. So I'm curious how you've navigated that, particularly the past few years.
Well, I've never done anything I didn't actually really want to do, really. So that's been good. That's been useful because it means that you can trust your instincts in a way, or at least, yeah. But are you saying, what do you mean that I don't want to do that anymore? What specifically do you mean by that?
I suppose, as these kinds of conversations have started up more, thinking about what a movie's trying to say in a way that maybe you just hadn't thought of it. Like, say, the way Leo Grand talks about sexuality. Even for me watching that movie, it was extremely eye-opening, and it's not necessarily something that any movie had presented to me, so therefore I couldn't think of not doing the alternate, say, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain stories we really do have to stop telling because I think they're quite damaging.
Right.
I think two of those are, one is And They Lived Happily Ever After. That's just bullshit. And and I think that romantic stories need to really start to... And again, you know, Noah did that brilliantly, I thought, in Marriage Story, you know, really exploring how something can become utterly destroyed and then something else can grow out of it. That's a kind of very good example of the destruction of And They Live Happily Ever After, because it represents, you know, that the first stages of love and then how terribly wrong that can go, how painful. That happens to most people in their lives at some point. And any good marriage actually involves death and rebirth and death and rebirth. But we don't tell that story. So everybody goes, oh my God, a death's come along. I can't deal with it. I'll move on. So that one. The other story that we really need to stop telling is about one man saving the world. This is just a very, very dull story. It just has to stop. It has to stop. I'm so bored. And when I talk to my brilliant producer friend, Lindsay Duran, she does a talk about the female hero and, you know, what writers are told. And they're told the most extraordinary things now in this today. You know, they're told, well, you know, she can't cry. She can't cry because that's showing feminine weakness. So she's got to be badass. So all the female tropes now have to be like the men. And so you go, well, hang on a second.
Yeah. There's a big gap here. Yeah.
It's the same story. We have to go into the in-between bit and say, but what is this that we're representing? We're just saying the same thing again and again. And actually, it occurred to me that the story about one man saving the world is in fact incredibly damaging, because if you think that that's what you're supposed to do, then you're always going to be disappointed in yourself. You're never going to shake. You're never going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. We can't do that. None of us can do that. God knows we would like to. I would love it. I grew up identifying with all of those male heroes who saved the world in whatever way they did, whether it was in a Texan town on a horse, you know, whether it was in space or whatever. But that story just has to go.
Yeah. I think Leo Grand is a good example of a movie that does the very opposite of that.
Yeah, it really does, because it actually acknowledges in really genuine ways and authentic ways the complexity of the human condition. And we're not very good at recognizing how complicated we are. And if we were better at it, we'd be much calmer, actually. We're so anxious. Human beings are naturally anxious anyway, but we don't recognize that either. So many of our stories are about how to be certain. And that's one of the most vulnerable places you can be.
Indeed. All right, Emma, where we are out of time, but thank you so much. This was really wonderful.
Oh, thank you, David. That was so great to talk to you.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday. In the meantime, find us on Twitter at HWD and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich, and David?
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.